in your circumstance, I would say, I know how you operate. Who knows how long you'll be in D.C., right?
They were calling me two-year T the other day.
Two-year T.
Hey, it's but, 1 year this week. 1 year this week.
Oh, wow. Hey, congrats.
Thank you. Yeah. halfway there.
Yeah, right?
Welcome to season two of Boomer Meets World. I'm Therese, the boomer.
I'm Dom from Gen Z. And we started this podcast to talk about everything under the sun, from more serious things to the not so serious things, and just offer our takes on it.
We hope you'll enjoy the show. I've been looking at buying a house. Well, probably not a house.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Why not?
Well, my lease is up, and you know, I live in the DC area. It's very expensive.
Yeah. Ridiculous. No surprise there.
And I'm paying almost $3,000 a month for a 2-bedroom apartment.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Which would be a very nice house where you're living, probably, but not that great of an apartment here. So I'm trying to figure out its location. It's where the place is, but I've been trying to figure out, should I just buy something? If I'm paying this much money, I might as well be making, you know, building some equity.
Right, which is the big argument for buying something.
Right. So I talked to an agent. I looked at a couple of condos. The biggest struggle I have right now is I don't have a decent down payment.
Mm, yeah.
So we're having to play a little bit of a shell game with the numbers just to get into something. But, you know, a 1-bedroom, 1-bath condo can be $250,000 here.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's pricey, but for your area, it makes sense.
Right. The worst part about it is that on top of the payment, you have condo fees.
Yeah.
And depending on what building you're in or what development you're a part of, I was looking at one that is for 55 plus. There's a golf course there and
pools
and some other things going on, right? But it's mm-hmm. a little bit older. It's not like it's brand new. It's built in the 90s, I think.
Okay.
And the homeowner's fees range anywhere from about $650 a month to $1,300 a month.
Holy shit.
No kidding, right?
Oh.
So you're talking about two mortgage payments, not one.
Really. Yeah. Yeah, at least. Yeah.
Because a $250,000 property, I don't want to say I could easily afford, but would be affordable to me at this point. It's the HOA fees on top of it that are killing me. So trying to find something that is available in a decent area that I can get before it's gone, that's the other thing. There's not a lot of inventory in my price range. Many townhomes in the area I'm in and the areas I'm looking in, townhomes are like $650,000 to
holy shit,
$850,000.
And what are those? Like how many bedrooms? How many bathrooms?
So they're probably 2 or 3 bedrooms, 2 or 3 baths, 2-story, maybe 3-story, depending.
So like closer to the starter home kind of area?
Probably, yes.
Probably even a little bit bigger if you're talking about like 3 and 2.
And if you're looking at certain parts of the Washington, D.C. area, those mm-hmm. can go well over $1 million.
Holy shit.
Based on location, again, and finishes and, you know, when it was built, all that stuff.
And these are like 1,000 to 1,500 square feet, roughly?
Probably. Yeah.
Okay.
Crazy town, right? Think about the square footage, the price per square foot or something like that, you know?
A little expensive.
Right. So the question is then, okay, do I continue to rent or do I try to buy? Interest rates suck right now. They're probably not going to get any better let me ask you that question because I know you own a couple of properties.
Yep.
My guess is you want to expand that ownership at some point. Maybe you've got a pin in it mm-hmm. right now because of a wedding coming and because of the interest rates, perhaps. Have you been keeping your eye on this stuff?
Yeah, I have. My mom and I will go back and forth a lot. And send listings to each other and crunch numbers. And I mean, I love the numbers. So I'll constantly be like, oh, I wonder if I could swing that, or how could I swing that? But it is tough. Like, it's a lot. When I first started this, I started looking in like the summer of 2019. Mm-hmm. And I kind of messed around before then, but seriously started looking at buying first home in 2019. And when at that time, you know, interest rates on average were like 4.5%, maybe a little bit less than that.
Right.
And I got lucky. I found a house in my town that was undervalued and needed work. That was the problem. But for the price point and whatnot. And then I was able to get like a 3.75% interest rate.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Now you talk about now, and it averages more than double that. Because it's I don't want to call it fascinating, because it's more horrifying than fascinating. You know, because like you talk about like how much interest rates can change your math on what you're actually going to be paying, you know, every month. And it's wholly different, because interest rates are still, I mean, you're looking at lowest possibly 7.25, but more likely like 7.5 to 8%. And then if you got bad credit, you're over 8.
Yeah, for sure. And if you're looking at, like in my case, for a condo, add half a percentage point automatically to the interest rate.
Are they doing that because of HOAs and because of like a restricted use?
I don't know. I mean, it's primary resident. That's me. But apparently condos, I don't know about townhouses, because again, I can't afford a townhouse in this town. But I think that you have, maybe it's a different kind of risk or something, but it's half a percentage point up. I mean, I have really good credit. You know, excellent mm-hmm. credit in the rate. Like if they rate it, it's excellent. And still, the rate that I got with the half a percentage point on top of it was like 8.125.
Wow.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it is. So
ridiculous to me, because my last townhouse in Florida, I had 2.75 was my finance. I mean, that was just amazing.
So I was reading an article a while ago, and I forget where I was reading it at, but it was a while ago, I think over the summertime. And they were saying that if you had a sub 3% mortgage rate, then you were part of 10% of homeowners in the US. Like, that's how rare 2% is.
Yeah. They had, again, I refinanced. I had it, I think it was probably 3.5 or something, mm-hmm. and refinanced and got another quarter down or something. And I kind of weighed, is it worth it? But apparently, if you get more than half a percentage off, it can be worth it to you to refinance. And I had done that and was just thrilled. But you know, a different president comes in, we have COVID, there's a economy shift, and all of a sudden now I'm looking at 8%, and it's really hard to swallow.
Oh yeah.
Not like the 80s, when I think in the 80s I wasn't buying a house, but something says 20% to me.
Can
you imagine buying a house with 20% interest rate? How would you even pay for
that? No. Well, I mean, this is where math is kind of crazy, because one of the big differences being the 80s is that the price points were so much lower.
So were the incomes. The incomes were so much lower too. So they didn't have the same.
But buying power was a lot different. So I'm not saying that, like, overall, right, like the cost of living was lower. So yes, your dollars in your bank account were less because salaries were lower. But I mean, you'd have to go back and like really do the math and find out
the comparison. Like,
yeah. When you adjust it for, you know, today's dollars and inflation, see where it's at. But I mean, 20% is still ridiculous. I mean, that's still very, very costly. And especially like, I don't know how many homeowners think about this or future homeowners, but your biggest cost of your 30-year mortgage is the interest payments. It's not what you borrow. It's the cost of borrowing. You end up paying like on average 2 to 3 times what you borrow by the end, because that's how much interest, you know, piles up. And then even too, like, that's why they always make the joke when you go to close, they're like, don't look at the amortization schedule. Because
it'll make a joke.
Yeah, because you see, like, you don't even start like the majority of your payment going towards principal as opposed to interest, like, doesn't even flip until, like, you know, somewhere in the, depending on all those variables, right, your down payments and whatnot, somewhere between like year 15, you know, and that's when you're, or maybe you're 20, and then you're like, holy shit, now we're actually on the back end of this, but it's brutal up until then.
And the crazy thing is too, right now with interest rates being so high, credit card rates are high too. Some people up near 30%.
Oh yeah, but credit cards have always been evil.
Yeah. Well, they are, absolutely. But I can remember at one point having a credit card that I think had somewhere between like around 11%, which is amazing now. I've got, like I said, I have excellent credit, and I still think my credit cards are in the low to mid 20s.
Oh yeah,
interest rate,
which is pretty standard,
right? And I think that's a real ridiculous ripoff right there. There's no way in heck that a credit card company, unless what they're basically probably making you do is, the good credit person, the person who pays their bills all the time, is helping them write off all this other stuff when people don't pay their credit card bills.
Well, I don't know, because this, so I call credit cards evil, and that's more hyperbolic, because really it's more like, they're just, in reality, they're more predatory.
Yeah.
Because absolutely. Because I mean, basically, if you have like a 760 credit score, right, that's like about like 760 to 799 is what they would consider like, what I think, very good credit. And what's interesting too is that even if you break into the 800s, which is like I think it's on a scale, it's like 800 to 850 is the last range, and that's excellent credit, you know, exceptional credit, all that. Like, even when you break into the 800s, you don't really see that much of savings come your way,
right?
Like, you get probably less fuss around you from underwriters and all that stuff. But it's interesting, because like, as long as you hit 760, you usually got the best rates. But then what's interesting is, when looking at credit cards, is like, their standard APR is like 15 to 35%. Like, that's just like, I have never had a credit card, and I have pretty good credit, I've never had a credit card less than, I think, 20% interest. And, you know, I treat my credit card like a debit card. So as soon as stuff posts, like, I've never made a late payment, because I understand that, you know, 30% on $1,000, you know, daily. Yeah. And it's like, and then, oh, you don't pay that, well, that gets rolled into your other purchases for the next statement. And then that's, you know, then it gets added to the principal, and just, it snowballs into, you know, the credit card crisis that we have in America.
And minimum payments will never get you to pay it off. I don't care at what level. And that's why I think you were talking about that house too. If you can pay double house payments, which I would never be able to do here, or even just some extra, a few hundred dollars extra every payment, that's going to help a lot with cutting down how much of that interest you pay over time.
Oh yeah.
You're not going to see it, you know, for 30 years maybe. And assuming that you're buying this house and that's where you're going to live for the rest of your days, I think something I wanted to ask you about, and take a little bit of a left turn, but
yeah,
how do you buy a house with nothing down these days? Because I know investors figure out how to do that. I can't figure out, I'm probably not in a position to do that, but I was just curious how, if you've done it and how that's done.
Well, I haven't bought anything with nothing down. My first home, that was a primary was I was able to get down to 3% down. But the house also needed a ton of work. So originally it was like we made an offer for 5. And then before close, we adjusted it to 3 so I could save cash and fix up the house some more.
Okay.
And then after a while and improvements were made, yada, yada, yada. The big difference being that I eventually ended up renting it, which is why I'm able to have 2 houses, is because it's like I'm not paying, like I am paying 2 mortgages a month, but I have rental income on those properties. Sure. So it's substantially different, right? There's still risk involved, but it's not like I have a primary home and a second home and I'm just living the high life. Woo-hoo! Paying 2 mortgages. Yeah. And
I'm glad you straightened that out, because I knew that, but I didn't, you know. Okay. So the question is then, so they're now both non-primary homes for you, because you rent them both out. Is that, besides insuring them, probably has to, that's probably a different insurance avenue that you have to go down, right?
No, it's, you can get, I mean, you still go through like your State Farms or your All States or Progressives.
Is it more expensive though?
It's actually cheaper.
Really?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, if I were to go, so this is where it gets, man, this is, wow. We're really about to go down a rabbit hole, but I love this stuff. So, first thing is, like, in the standard homeowners market, a homeowner can buy anything that is 4 units or less. Okay. As soon as you go to a 5 unit building, which, you know, people don't realize is, like, if you're a homeowner and you want to go buy a building that has 3 extra units in it, you know, basically like a small apartment, you can get a normal mortgage in what they call the qualitative market. And so, like, your Rockets or your UWMs or, you know, your big box lenders will give you a loan for anything that's 4 units or less.
Okay.
And then if you're a first time home buyer and it's going to be your primary, you don't have to put 20% down. Like, you, there's programs where you can only put like 5 or 10% down.
You're getting old, buddy.
Yeah, right. The difference between like 2019 and today, you know, just 5 years later, is that, like, back in 2019, it wasn't advantageous to put 20% down because interest rates were so low in comparison, right? That putting all that extra money into the house, yeah, you wouldn't have to pay private mortgage insurance, you know, which is like usually 0.5%, whatnot.
Yeah.
But it was so much more cash to put up front and it wouldn't really save you that much. Now, if you don't put 20% down, we've kind of gone back to that recommendation where it's like, now you really should think about putting 20% down, because if you only put 5% down and your interest rate is 8% instead of 3%, like it was 5 years ago, that's a whole lot more money.
Right.
Now you're talking $1,000 difference. You know, $500 to $1,000 difference depending on your purchase price. So it gets complicated, but what happens is when you move into like 5 units and above, which people would call multifamily, anything commercial, like anything you'd rent to a business or anything like that, like 5 units residential, multifamily or commercial, it's completely different ball game. The avenues to getting loans in that area are vastly different. And they're not, the biggest thing is they're not backed by the government. Okay. So when you move into that realm, you're dealing with big companies who have a private branch of themselves, or you're dealing with literally private investors who you're borrowing money from, and the interest rates are typically a little higher because there's, you know, again, there's not that government backing.
Right. Greater risk.
Yeah.
For the lender. Yeah.
Yeah. But they have some cool loans out there. For example, there is a loan called a DSCR loan. And what it stands for is a debt service coverage ratio loan. And basically, a multifamily or commercial lender, either a company or a private lender, will give you money based on the future cash flows. Because this is not, obviously, like, once you can't claim something as a primary, it's not like people are going to go buy a a 6-unit building and be like, oh, it's my primary. It's like, no, that is now firmly in the multifamily. Like,
well, what if you were going to live in one and rent the others?
You could, but it would no longer be called a primary. It would fall under business, or it would be treated like a business.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if it was 4 or less and you did that.
If it was 4 or less, you would just be in the normal mortgage market you could claim it as a primary.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is helps you substantially with taxes. That's what's important, because most municipalities, once you classify the property as a non-primary residence, mm-hmm. your property taxes skyrocket.
Okay. Yeah, what happened in Florida. I mean, when I bought in Florida, that was a big thing, because it would be almost double
your
property tax.
And you'll see, like, some municipalities, like, they're always higher. They're never going to be lower than a primary tax, but some municipalities have much higher non-primary taxes than primary taxes. So, but anyways, so the DSCR loans, right? They're pretty cool, because you get a loan based on the future cash flows and the future rents. And some of these loans, they require you to have reserves. Like, you have to prove that you have, like, say, like 3 to 6 months of cash to make sure that you can pay for things, mm-hmm. like all the costs. But all of these, or I shouldn't say, most of them are no money down. Like, like, for example, UWM, they have DSCR loans now. And there are some loan packages that if you show you have 3 to 6 months reserves, you can get up to like $3 million borrowed.
Okay, so you've got that in your mattress like that? 3 to 6 months? I'm just kidding.
Well, no, I don't have it in my mattress. It's in my walls.
Okay. A little bit safer. A little bit safer. Right? So that's kind of a cool thing, though, that... but again, unless you're somebody who is a big investor or something, I mean, how do you get there? I don't even have 20% to put down, which is part of the thing that's been a struggle for me, is like, okay, should I do this? I'm thinking that whatever I purchase based on my age and everything, you know, if I'm there 5 to 7 years, I'm not looking at it as this is my forever home, mm-hmm. long-term 30-year deal. So I'm just, one of the benefits of, even though I'm paying a lot of money, is the DC market usually is not impacted by the housing market of other places. Cause there's always people moving in and out of here because of regime changes. I mean, you know, political things, whatever. And that's the other thing going on
there too.
Exactly. And what's hard is when you work for a nonprofit like I do, your pay is not going to be at all what people in the government sector or private sector have for pay, if they're contractors, especially. So they're making a lot of money. I had a conversation with a guy at work today, and he said, when I was looking for a house, you know, I talked about it on the radio and I was just saying what was happening. And then this lady says, hey, I've got this house in my neighborhood that I think would be perfect for you or whatever. So she sends him the information, and it's like 6,500 square feet. And
holy shit.
Yeah. Like 2 acres and everything. And he says, it's like $1.5 million. So he reaches back out to the lady and goes, I can't pay half of this. And she's shocked, you know, because she's a government contractor. She's making a crap ton of money, and that's what happens around here. There's so much money in this area that it's very hard for us, you know, schlubs to get something and actually find a decent place to live that you can afford.
Well, and that is the tricky part, right? And I guess one thing to put into perspective is that the unfortunate reality of those mortgage rates that was 5 years ago, like, those are probably never coming back.
Yeah.
And I guess you should never say never, right? Because mm-hmm. things happen. But if you look at the historical averages, 7 to 9% is about where mortgage rates have always been. Now, they've had, you know, you look at, like, you're talking like the 80s when there was all kinds of economic problems, right? Yeah, you saw 10, 15, 20%, right? Which was insane. And that, I think that might have also been in the 70s too, because there were some problems there. But 7 to 9% has been pretty standard. And so I would say to someone like yourself and other people, like, if you're looking at the house market, I wouldn't wait for interest rates to come down. And
I'm not thinking that, because I mean, I agree with you. My thought is, if they do, bonus, great. I can refinance and I can get a little bit better payment or whatever. But yeah, I'm not really waiting on that. I wish I had more down payment. I just don't. So that's the thing that's probably hurting me the most right now, just because you can only have so much money.
Your problem is that you don't have enough down payment to make the payment affordable, or you don't have enough down payment because they're saying you have to have 20%.
No, I don't have to have 20. I can have 3, because in Maryland, they have a first-time home buyers.
Right, okay.
But it only applies to Maryland first-time home buyers, meaning I've owned four other houses. I can't remember how many other houses, but not here. So there is a 3% program that is a conventional loan. It's not FHA. I don't know if that still comes with mortgage insurance or not. I know FHA does.
It will still come with PMI.
Yeah. There's 3% plus closing costs. So then you're talking about, if you can get the seller, which it isn't exactly the market for that, but there was a time when it was a buyer's market and the seller would pay those closing costs for you. And I guess it depends on how desperate they are and what's going on in their world too. But
yeah,
that's the thing. I just don't have a lot of upfront money. So that makes this, even with 3%, that it's very limiting. I mean, $200,000, 3% is $6,000.
Yeah.
But then you need how much more to do the closing part of it. So,
and that's, so like, to your question, like, what should people do? Like, it is tough, right? You know, if someone was going to stay in a house for, you know, a long time, and, you know, you can tighten the belt around the budget and make do with it, you know, or as people call it, house poor, right?
Right.
It's not a fun way to live. It is nice to say, like, if you get a house in a appreciating market, to see, like around where I live, the average house appreciates about 5% a year, which has been like the 20-year average. And, you know, that is substantial, because that is what, I mean, home, unfortunately for most people, right, including myself, the most valuable thing we will ever own will be a house. And So a lot of people who, I get, there's like a lot of people in my generation who are focusing on renting, because, you know, you do the math and they're like, oh, well, it's more cost effective to rent instead of buy. It's like, yes, that might be true. But at the same time, that is at the cost of long-term appreciation, which, you know, if you stay in a house for even 5 to 10 years and it's in a stable market, your house should appreciate. And that when you go to sell it, maybe those 5 to 10 years weren't so great in terms of, like, you didn't have a ton of spending cash, but now you've also invested in this property, which someone is going to pay hopefully more for than you did. Mm-hmm. And now you get to go on your merry way with more cash in your pocket than you would have if you had just paid rental money.
Well, if I, even with 3% down, and I find something around 200 to 250,000.
Yeah.
Let's say. It's going to be less payment than my $2,700 rent payment that I'm paying now.
Right.
So I look at it as a kind of a double win, in that I'll have more money in my pocket every month, but I will also be building equity. So I have a little bit of kind of a win-win there. Now, of course, if anything goes wrong, that comes to me.
Right.
Financially. So there's all kinds of things that I understand why, especially some older people don't want to own, because then they have all those requirements.
Yeah,
that they have to take care of. But
in your circumstance, I would say, I know how you operate. who knows how long you'll be in DC, right?
They were calling me 2-year T the other day.
Hey,
it's but, 1 year this week. 1 year this week.
Oh, wow. Hey, congrats.
Thank you.
Yeah.
halfway there.
Yeah, right. In your shoes, I mean, I think for anyone, the general rule of thumb is that if you're gonna save money and or realize more personal wealth in the future by owning instead of paying, then I'd say that's the road to go down. And I guess that's, like I said, that's a general rule, right? There's obviously exceptions and caveats and all that stuff, but in your situation too, like, I think you could still benefit from it. And let's say you're owning it, and then you even 2 years, a year, whatever it is, you say I'm leaving DC, right? You have the option to also rent it, and you know how the rental market is, and you could turn around and take some rent on it. Now, condos are a little interesting because some places don't allow that. So I would say if you could find something that overall makes more financial sense than renting, and if you were to up and move, you could rent it out, and then I'd say, yeah, it makes sense. If it doesn't make financial sense, or you know, you're not sure if you're going to be there long term, and then maybe renting does make sense, even though it's more costly.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough.
Yeah, I feel like as I think about my place in the work world, that I'm coming closer, faster to the end of my work time. And where am I going to find a job this good somewhere else? I really like the people I work with. The pay is good considering the area being expensive and all that. But so I'm not necessarily thinking, okay, I'm bored, I'm going to move on or whatever it is right now. The last couple of jobs I had, unfortunately, were leadership was just abusive. It's probably the best way to put it.
Quality of life sucked.
Right. So that's not the case here. There are, you know, there's always stuff that you go, oh, I disagree with that. Or why do they do that stuff or whatever?
Oh,
but
yeah.
Those That's are everywhere. Little things. It's everywhere. You can't get around that. But so to me, I think if, okay, this is my last full-time job.
Uh-huh.
Then it's going to have to be 5 to 7 years more. So, you know, it might be the value might be in buying.
Yeah. And I would say so. I would say that if that's the case, and it makes sense, because you could look at, I mean, everyone should do this, right? When you're going to buy a home or anything, condo, apartment, or townhouse, whatever it is, right? You should look at the area that you're buying and just go through the pricing history or the values. I mean, even a general idea, right? Does it tend to tick upward, or do you see massive fluctuations every couple of years, right? Where it's like, maybe it's not such a stable market. But typically a good area that is stable should bring about 5% in appreciation year over year. And that adds up, you know, over 5 years, that makes a big difference.
It
now,
does.
Doesn't make your budget feel better, right? Like your budget's not going to change, but you know, maybe 5-7 years when you say, hey, you know, I'm done full-time job, you probably think yourself.
And I'm thinking too, what I'm trying to figure out is if I buy something, I could probably be in the $2,200 a month instead of $2,700 a month. But that also gives me room because HOA fees don't sit stable always.
Yeah.
So depending on that change or fluctuation, there's some room there where I wouldn't want to be so house poor I could never travel or do anything.
That's the other side of it too, right?
Yeah,
quality of life and a you know, actual life and budget sense.
Yeah. And so I'm going to talk my very savvy nephew into investing into a townhome. Just kidding. But so are you looking at, you said you and your mom, you know, kind of put listings back and forth and share stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you guys always on the hunt, so to speak, to look for just keeping your eyes open?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds weird, but it makes sense. You have to be more careful now, right? Like before, when it was 4% to borrow and you could buy a $250,000 house and your mortgage payment would only be $1,500, which is not cheap, right? But it's weird. So it's weird saying that. But it's like, wow, it's a lot easier to find $1,500 than it is to find $2,500.
Sure.
Right? Like if shit really hit the fan, I could live tight and I could make payments and we would be okay for a couple months. Now, when you're talking about, oh, well, now your payments are closer to $2,000, it's like, ooh, that's getting a little tougher now, right? And then the other thing too is like from a landlord perspective, right? Like it has to make sense. Like math, like you can't just go out and buy, you know, a move-in ready house, pay top dollar, and then turn around and try to make a profit on someone else paying for that. One, because if you can do it, they can do it. So why would they rent from you, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're competing against, you know, potential homeowners or would-be homeowners. And at the same time, it's like in my area, in my opinion too, like $2,800 a month is not reasonable, like for the Detroit area, right? And unless it's like a huge house, but if you're talking about renting out a starter home, it's like what family from the Detroit area is going to want to pay, you know, north of $2,500 a month,
or can pay that,
or can?
I don't,
yeah.
I don't know what their income is, but when you start to think about, okay, how much of my take home pay does this payment chop off? And that's what the hard thing is for me is, you know, this rental payment is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because of taxes and everything else involved with, you know, your paycheck, then you kind of go, okay, now how much do I want to be paying every month?
Yeah.
And can I buy a tiny house and where is one?
Yeah. So, I mean, my mom and I, we do look, but mm-hmm. we have to be more careful, right? Because you can't just go out and buy something and you got to make sure someone's going to want to pay the rental price for it. And that's why we always prefer stuff that's undervalued.
Sure.
Right. It's just the classic, you buy low, you sell high.
Fixer upper kind of deal.
Yeah, exactly. Within reason, right? I mean, if something is stripped down to the studs, it's like, oh, we're not quite ready for that.
Needs to be stripped down to the studs.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I, you know, this is something I try to tell my friends and, you know, people I meet and, you know, whatever, like, especially like the younger people, you know, it's like, hey, I get it. You want a house that you pay for it, you move in. Like there is a certain perk and bliss to that, right? Like it just,
a joy. Yes.
Yeah. But it's like, it's nice and it's comfortable and everything. But I was like, but if you really want the most advantageous, like long-term wealth benefit and cost savings, you got to buy something that needs some love. And I'm not saying, oh, there's a crack in the foundation or the roof is caving in or whatever, but it's like, it's amazing in the market. What I've seen is how adverse people are to painting or replacing carpet or, you know, updating light fixtures, stuff that I can do. I learned how to do. It took me some time, but it's not like I needed to pay an electrician to hang a light fixture.
No.
You know, so it's like if you are willing to put in the work and
With carpet, you can pay somebody to put the carpet in. You don't have to do it yourself.
No, you don't have
to. But you could rip it out and you could prepare and you could save money that way. So,
right.
Yeah.
So, but then that's the problem is like, I get this feeling from a number of people in my generation. I wouldn't say majority, but it's a number of people who just don't want to deal with stuff like that. And sure. You know, they all have their reasons and whatnot, but it's like, especially as a young person, like if you are physically capable, you're going to do yourself a lot more favors if you buy something that's undervalued and you put some love into it. Because other than that, it's like, I think about like, well, how much I make at my job and what my hourly wage is outside of work even, right? And being like, even at the gas pump, am I going to sit here for 30 minutes to try to get gas to save $3? Which I'm being, you know, I'm being a little exaggerative, but, or do I just go down the road, get what I'm with my day? Okay. I didn't say $3, but it's $3. Right. Whereas opposed to like, you know, I work in the construction side of purchasing and all that stuff, right? Standard labor hour is $100 an hour. So the question is, do you want to pay someone three times your salary? We'll just say, for example,
right,
to rip out carpet. It's like, you could do that. save a couple thousand bucks, you know? So that's what I wish more people my generation understood, because like, there are pros and cons, right, to everything, and it's not a one size fits all. But
I think especially the younger generation that, you know, they grew up in a nice house maybe with their parents and stuff, and they look at it as, well, this is what I want. And you're like, yeah, but your parents didn't start there either. In general, they didn't. My parents are still living in the house they bought, but that's what this is like their second house that they bought that they live in.
Well, and that's the thing,
and it
too,
looks
right?
like it too, because it needs a ton of work. Like,
yeah, but know? I mean, also look at all the work that like grandpa did to that place, you know, either through some contracting or himself or friends. You know, I'm not exactly sure, but like I can tell there's homeowner work. And it's like, you got seven kids, you know?
Oh, he had to be creative. Oh, yeah. He'll tell you the work is terrible upstairs where he created the bedrooms, but they didn't have any choice. They didn't have any money. So they were doing, you know, they bought the paneling that was ugly as crap because it was a great price, you know? And he learned how to do the cuts, and he just taught himself. And there was no YouTube back then. Now you could look online and go, oh, that's how you do a miter cut? Okay, let me see. And
that's a really good point. You know, I mean, I know that like there's a lot of complaints from my generation about how like we don't have shop class anymore in high school.
Yeah.
And I do think it'd be beneficial for a lot of young high schoolers to have shop class and learn these skills and whatnot. But to your point, it's an excellent point. You can look up almost anything you can fucking imagine on YouTube.
Yeah.
Anything. And sometimes these guys talk too much, like I talk too much. But it's like, holy shit. I can teach myself to a degree a lot of things. And those things can save a lot of money.
And you can go out and rent the tools too, where I'm not sure that back in the day, when my dad was doing that work, that he could rent.
Oh, that's interesting.
Most of those tools, he might have had to purchase the saws or whatever he needed to do the work. But I don't know that for sure. I just remember.
Well, it's probably like you didn't have as many like Home Depots, right? It was more like local stores and stuff like that. And you also local probably had a lot more tradespeople too.
Absolutely. And that's what you said, like tapping into people he knows that know how to do stuff, whether it was plumbing or electrical or, you know, like when they did the floors, they ripped up the carpet and did the floors in their house, their hardwoods. Yeah. I think your dad did that work or.
Oh, really?
I don't know if he did it or it was somebody he knew, but, you know, that's what you have to get creative with it. You don't have to, you know, go out and hire some contractor to do your work. I mean, depending on what it is, for sure. You don't want to tear down a wall without knowing what.
Well, you know what
is
it is. No, you're right. Yeah, you got to, and you also got to be careful because, like, I have some friends that try to do some homeowner work, and they live in cities that are really strict about pulling permits.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I had a buddy; he was doing some drywall work, and the city drove by and saw drywall on the curb and is like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm just replacing drywall. And they're like, do you have a permit for that? And he's like, oh, I don't need a permit. And they're like, well, we're going to need to come into your house and inspect. And he's like, oh, fuck, no, you're not.
Oh, but man.
So there is a lot. I think my assumption, correct me if I'm wrong, my assumption was that your generation and like your parents' generation and, you know, even up until like, say, like the 80s was a lot more do it yourself, where you saw a lot more home projects and you saw a lot more. Now, I'm not saying good, right? I'm not saying like quality, because but my point is that like from my experience working on houses, there's a lot of times when I open up a wall or open up a light fixture or I'm like, oh, this is homeowner work, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as opposed to, I know a lot of people who aren't doing that, and they are getting a better product because there are more professionals per se doing this stuff. But it's like, I can just tell by how many projects I have done or helped people with that there must have been a ton of people at one point in time doing a ton of stuff themselves.
Had to, I would think, just because they couldn't afford to do otherwise. And I feel like now it comes down to two things, I think, time and money.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe three, skill. So if I'm going to, say, replace a countertop, that's probably a hard thing to do.
That's maybe a little harder.
Okay, painting your cabinets.
Okay, you could do that.
It's old cabinets.
Homeowner can do that, yeah.
Yeah, you totally could do that yourself. But you have to think, you have to work through that. Okay, I have to sand this surface all off. I have to make sure.
If you can sand it.
Yeah, if you can. And then I need to buy the right kind of paint. I can't just buy any paint and slap it on there. And it's going to be a process. It's not going to be a weekend project because it takes some time. There's a lot of nooks and crannies in that. So all that stuff, then you go, okay, do I just want to pay a professional to do it and save myself the heartache? Well, if you've got the money, sure, go for it. But there's things that you can do yourself, like you said, that would help. Like there, I looked at a condo. I considered, actually put in an offer, didn't get it. But the condo had those old oak cabinets with the oak. They had put the oak doors on them, you know, that just kind of standard old 80s or 90s.
Were they blonde color?
No, they were more that yellowy, orangey color, you know.
Yeah, okay. Oak. Like just shy of like a knotty pine cabin?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, I'm like, oh, these are ugly, but they're in decent condition and they're solid, you know.
Which is hard to find now, too.
Yes, exactly. So I thought, okay, well, first off, I have a friend who used to do that for a living, so I can call her and say, fly up here and you're gonna do this for me. But, you know, I mean, there's things that you can do yourself, like you said, that, you know, you can save a lot of money to do, and it makes a big difference. Paint, for one thing.
Right.
It makes a huge difference in many cases, and it's time consuming, but you can do it yourself.
My mom always refers to painting a room as the cheapest and most effective renovation you can do that just changes the space.
In so many ways. First off, depending on how bad the paint job is already or how much damage is there or whatever, the colors, you know, if you go with a light gray or you go with a white or something and you just make it, you can freshen it up. But also sometimes it even helps with the smell. The older house, you know, you don't know if they were smoking or whatever. You can do a lot with that. So anyway, we're sort of off topic. Hey, surprise. So let me ask you a question. We'll come back around to we were talking about. If I have a chance to buy a condo, maybe lower my monthly payment, 600 square feet can be $250,000 in this.
Holy shit.
Now, there are others that aren't. They're bigger, but they're still one bedrooms or whatever. You know, you're talking about renting and paying that money or buying and paying that money. What kind of advice would you give to me? Not that I'm going to hold you to it or blame you for anything. I'm just curious. Would you say continue to look and if you find something great, or would you say, well, maybe you ought to just stick to renting?
If your total out-of-pocket costs, HOA fees, taxes, mortgage, like whatever your monthly payment is going to be, if that payment is going to be cheaper, I think there is still an advantage to you personally and your budget to buy something.
How much cheaper if you would? So if I'm going to be paying, my new lease is $2,700.
Okay.
I already told him. Kick rocks. I'm not going to stay here. But if I'm looking at that as that's what my payment would be, would you say $100, $300, $500, or does that not matter as much as?
The more you can save, the better, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But I mean, if your total, even if you save, let's say worst case, you only save $100 a month, right? The question is, what else do you become on the hook for, right? Because like condos are different, right? With the HOAs and all that stuff, right? Where it's like, if your furnace were to break in an HOA community, like, would you be responsible for that or not? And I guess The question is, if you were, then maybe $100 isn't enough. But if your total went down to 25, and for example, and you weren't on the hook for, you know, maintenance costs and all of that,
yeah,
then I think what you could then do is you can say that $200 extra dollars is more money in your pocket to do with you as you please, or it's more money to invest in retirement, right? Like, you're opening up cash for the future. And then on top of that, hopefully your property is also appreciating, because yeah, then you'll get your bigger paycheck. So you might not see as much now, but 5 years from now, when you go to cash out, you're like, oh, well, there you go. There's that 5% per year that came back, and it feels a lot better. So it's hard to say without knowing all of the variables.
I'm trying to be 400-ish. Well, I'd love to be around 700 less a month. I'm not sure I can quite get there, but at least 400
yeah,
is my hope, so that it makes sense. And then you can always get the home warranty things that sometimes make sense and sometimes they don't.
Warranties are, I don't know.
Yeah, they don't always matter. Well, in this case, the one that I had made the offer on, the agent was going to put it in that the seller has. So, I mean, she was throwing everything in under the sun in there on the seller side.
Oh, yeah.
Which was great. I mean, it's all negotiating, but, you know, it can't hurt to try. So you're right. I look into the HOAs closely. The lower the HOA, the less they include. I mean, usually if it's a house, it's just, we're going to remove snow, we're going to mow the common areas, and yeah, maybe, and the snow removal is probably just for streets. Even it's probably not even your driveway and stuff. Now in a condo, it's a different story because it's community living. It's a little bit different. They,
right,
they do that kind of thing. That's included. Sometimes your water, like in the retirement community I looked at, it was the higher the HOA, you'd get all everything, like all your utilities, including cable and internet and stuff, all included in there. But it could cost you $1,100 or $1,200 or $1,300 a month. Well,
yeah, it's just ridiculous.
I don't use that much water and electric. And I mean, between water, electric, and gas, in which I have all three in this current apartment, I don't think I use more than $150 a month, all three combined. So why would I want to pay all that extra?
Well,
unless I want the amenities. The amenities are what you're paying for in that place.
But that's my issue with HOAs and maintenance agreements and warranties and stuff like that. Like, it to me, by and large, they sound like the add-ons that a dealership tries to make you buy at the end, right? Where it's like,
you want tire protection? Do you want?
Yeah,
this?
I mean, it really depends. Like, you know, if you're 85 years old and you can't shovel snow and you can't do all this and that, like, yeah, okay, it makes sense. You want someone to do it for you. But
yeah,
you know, that like you said, like the HOA covers cable. Well, if there's, you know, I don't know, say 50 units, right, and they're all marking up, well, you getting cable included. Well, they're going back to a cable provider and getting a bulk discount, mm-hmm, that they're probably marking up back to you.
And then the crazy thing is, and just because I had this when I was in the apartment in Ohio, it just, if everybody's watching TV at the same time and in a retirement community, that's probably a guarantee. then you're getting glitching and you're getting, you know, because there's just not enough stuff. So there's, it's not always a deal to do that. Usually you have an option to upgrade, but I don't know if, anyway, but
yeah,
okay. So you, in general, you think if I can save a few $100 a month, and, you know, like the place and it fulfills whatever, then you would probably say do it. Because
right,
this is, I mean, and obviously I do have an agent and I've been very clear with her saying, I do not want to be in some place that's not safe.
Yeah.
And, you know, some other things that have been important to me. I don't want to be too far away from work.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes sense.
So there's things that, you know, but everybody in this area drives like an hour one way. And I'm like, oh,
right,
that is not happening because they can't afford anything.
Right.
Unless you are making a crud ton of money. But
well, and that's the thing. Like, like I said, even $100 a month of savings helps, right?
Yeah.
Every little bit helps. And especially it helps if you're not assuming more costs, right? If you can actually save $100 and that will stay in your pocket and not leave your pocket at some point, that helps. And then you could do the responsible thing and invest that $100, or you could, you know, also just enjoy life because life is short.
I'm enjoying life.
I mean, it's tough, you know, because it's, you know, if it was up to like the Dave Ramseys of the world, they'd be like, save everything and don't take out any debt and blah, 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 and you got to work 60 hours and pay off your mortgage in 7 years. And it's like, yeah, but that's not a great life either.
And I'm not saying that you should take on a bunch of debt, you know, but the radical side of that is, what if you drop dead because you've been working 60 hours a week and then you...
What was the fucking point?
Exactly. I'm saying there's got to be a balance to it.
Absolutely.
Like you, in order to buy a house, you have to create a credit history. So to never have a credit card, I don't know how you do that. You know, he would talk. That's how he would talk. But
yeah, well, those are necessary evil.
Like you said,
I go back to evil.
Yeah, we circle around back to and we say maybe get a credit card, but pay it off every month and use it carefully.
The minimum is a trap. Don't give those greedy people any more money than you owe them.
The next time Dom will share his real feelings about this. Well, thank you. I appreciate your help with that and comments and stuff. And we'll see what happens.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Boomer Meets World. If you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and like us and give us a good review. To reach out with a question or topic idea, email us at podcast@boomermeetsworld.com.